5 years ago, Taylor Swift surprise released an album that reoriented her career forever. In the midst of a global pandemic, she put her blonde ambition aside for a moment, said goodbye to synth and pop hooks, and created an album that captured not only the zeitgeist of that moment, melancholic isolation, but also reunited her with a version of herself that seemed lost to the sands of time. Indeed, she had declared that version of herself dead on Reputation. But here she was, again, the Taylor Swift that the public adored, not the embattled, fickle, petty pop star she had been portrayed as and had leaned into as a character post her massively successful transition into pure pop. No, this was someone else, the return of the very soul and essence of an artist whose magnetism lifted her high enough to abandon that essence in the first place. Here she was again, the dreamer, the feeler, the writer. If you're asking me, the Swiftologist, whether her pop albums prior to Folklore had artistic merit, I would of course answer yes, but that's not how the general public perceived it. In the glow of Tay optimism and Tay positivity that followed with the re-recordings project and the Eras Tour, it's very easy to forget that for everyone, Taylor Swift included, in 2019, it seemed like her spotlight was dimming. Lover particularly signaled a general decline in her songwriting prowess. It wasn't bad, but there was very little bite. It lacked the kind of tumult, energy, and desperation that animated her prior records. At least with Reputation, which was received with very mixed reviews from the public and the critics, there were conversation starters, Look What You Made Me Do being one of the last truly monocultural moments created by a music video. The most worrying part about Lover's release was how little people seemed to care beyond showing disdain for its childish, kitschy aesthetics and, to put it politely, misguided attempts at advocacy. In Miss Americana, a documentary filmed to coincide with the Lover era, Taylor opines about the expiration date of a female pop star. She seemed, in that moment, convinced that on her 30th birthday, she would turn into a pumpkin, having to retreat behind the scenes and pen hits for other people. This documentary premiered just 7 months before she revolutionized her songwriting and altered her fate as a public figure forever. Welcome to my channel, or welcome back to my channel. My name is Zach. I am the Swiftologist. I make thoughtful weekly videos. And today I'm going to be talking about what else? The 5th anniversary of Folklore. Did you know that that means it's also 5 years of me doing this YouTube channel? That's right, my Folklore reaction was the very first video that I ever uploaded, and I'm kind of gagged by that. I can't believe that it has been 5 years, this YouTube channel, and you guys have completely changed my life, and I feel so grateful to have this platform and to still be here doing this 5 years later. I never imagined sitting there and turning my camera on just to record my reaction to my favorite artist's first surprise album for posterity, that it would turn into all of this. So I'm so grateful. And to say thank you, I'm going to be reacting to my Folklore album reaction, the very first video I ever did, on the Patreon for all of the members. So go to patreon.com/Swiftologist if you would like to see me react to my very first YouTube video. Warning, I will be cringing.
That was absolutely outstanding. It is.
Absolutely outstanding. I don't think so. The release week efforts for Lover were ginormous. Numerous daytime talk show appearances, a pop-up shop, secret sessions, collaborations with Stella McCartney, and yet the album still failed to reach the peak of her prior blockbusters. It debuted with 867,000 equivalent album units in the US, with 679,000 of those being pure sales, making it the fastest-selling album by a female artist in 2019. Impressive on paper, sure, but still a clear drop from Reputation's 1.23 million and 1989's 1.28 million. It was the first real sign that Taylor's commercial grip at launch might be slipping. Streaming didn't really pick up the slack either. Lover racked up about 226 million streams in the US in its first week, a solid figure, but 60 million less than Folklore's debut, which is a notably less streamable album. And the singles? Big debuts, soft landings. Me and You Need to Calm Down came in hot but didn't stick, and No Song on Lover before the Eras Tour claimed a number one on the Hot 100. By the end of 2019, Lover had cleared 3 million in global sales and passed a million in the US, but it was also her first album since crossing over to pop that didn't produce a multi-week Hot 100 number one or hit the multi-platinum mark in the US. For an artist who built her reputation on record-breaking launches and cultural chokeholds, Lover felt like a pivot point, a moment when the machine stuttered. And if that was the beginning of a downward trend, Folklore, thankfully, was the hard reset. The throat clear on the opening track, The One, is even more powerful than the one on Ready For It. I'm doing good, I'm on some new shit. Been saying yes instead of no. This is an extremely casual way to engage the listener. It's not the overwrought statement introduction, like the forced cheer of I forgot that you existed or the posturing on Ready For It. It's less a statement and more of an invitation. It's the first song we ever hear of Taylor's new collaborative romance with Aaron Dessner, and his footprint is very important. The production is incredibly stripped back compared to what we had just heard from her. The arrangement for this song revolves around a gentle rhythmic piano, and it's complemented by subtle percussion and very delicate strings. Sonically, this album opener situates us in the woods captured on the album cover. Taylor's vocal delivery is clipped, muted almost. It gives a conversational effect. You can hear that she's reminiscing, somewhat sadly, about something she no longer has, or maybe never even really had in the first place. Sonically, it situates us in a walk down memory lane, a place that we're all frequenting day in and day out at this period of time in history. With lockdowns and outbreaks, it feels like for the first time ever, the whole world has stopped turning. There's nothing for anyone to do but sit still and reflect. It turns out that many of us had been subconsciously running from something. Folklore invites you to catch up with that something, the terror, the dream, the former flame, a story you never had the time to tell, a loss you never processed, a new life you shouldn't dare to imagine. For some time, Taylor had used her words as an artist like a sword, thrust outwards to gut her enemies or protect her from further ruin. But here on Folklore, she lays the sword down and lets her words become a comfort blanket instead, or maybe an old cardigan under someone's bed, if you will. Writing had once again, after quite some time, become her tool to self-soothe rather than explain or avenge. Talking about Folklore always makes me a little emotional, not just because of the album itself, but because it reminds me of how lucky we were to get the Eras Tour. Remember those Folklore moments on the stage, the cabin, the gowns, running across the stage during August, life-changing. And yes, I got my Eras Tour tickets on SeatGeek, which is why I want to give the sponsor of today's video, SeatGeek, a huge shout out. With over 28 million downloads, SeatGeek is the number one rated ticketing app, and for good reason. They've got tickets to more than 70,000 live events, concerts, sports, festivals, you name it. Right now, you can get seats for Beyonce, SZA, Coldplay, Dua Lipa, Tate McRae, Lady Gaga, The Weeknd, and so much more. I genuinely love how easy SeatGeek makes it. Every ticket is rated from 1 to 10, so you know exactly what kind of deal you're getting. Green dots mean good, red dots mean runaway, bad deal. And every ticket is backed by their buyer guarantee, which takes the stress out of the whole experience. If you're planning to scream and cry at your next concert, same, I've got you. Use the code SwiftOlogist10 for 10% off your next set of tickets. Click the link in the description to download the app, and the code will be automatically applied to your account. Thank you again so much to SeatGeek for sponsoring this video, and fingers crossed, there will be a Taylor Swift tour that I can use SeatGeek to get tickets for very soon. I think you can literally hear her being freed from the shackles of trying to be the 24/7 doll domination diva. Pop star Barbie is a role that Taylor plays very well, but it's not the core competency of who she is as a writer, nor is it the most compelling piece of her artistry to her listeners. Taylor Swift's greatest skill and best-selling point has always been her ability to read you her diary and make it feel like she's reading yours. Somehow, she manages to articulate all of these feelings, thoughts, and experiences in the constricting form of a pop song. Writing good, relatable music is much harder than it seems. There are only so many human experiences to describe and embody. The trick of the craft is how creatively you can present your version of the human condition. One might be tempted when trying to make something relatable to lean into platitudes and genericisms, because that's relatable, right? Yes and no. Taylor herself has inspired a whole generation of young artists who mimic her, and this is pretty much exactly what they do, and exactly why it's almost never good or original. Just because something is relatable or confessional doesn't automatically make it art. The skill lies in the presentation of the feeling, and this is where Taylor Swift excels, and we see this so clearly on Folklore, not only in song, but in world-making. Every era that she has is distinct. It has a visual language, it has signs and symbols, mini stories that unfold by themselves, often in relation maybe to some work that came before it. Folklore was, for sure, a gamble, though. It flipped the entire Taylor Swift operation on its head. She was famous for the protracted rollout, the elaborate process of teasing, Easter egging, shoving the album down your throat. She had broken away from her Everything Everywhere All at Once strategy once before during Reputation, but there was still a huge and concerted long tail and push behind it. Why did she love to release music this way? Because it allowed her to expand her storytelling beyond the songs, yes, but also it gives her the limelight for a really long period of time while promoting a project, which ultimately allows her to sell very many copies of it. By the time Folklore was released, though, she had already trained her hounds on how to interact with a new release. So in theory, giving up on that opportunity to drag it out was a very big gamble on the quality of the work. If it's good, it'll sell. Luckily, Taylor Swift is extremely attuned to the moment. More often than not, she understands exactly what her audience wants from her, whether anyone else can see this or not. Her label, for example, let's recall the grief Big Machine gave her when she went full pop for 1989. Her connection to the fan base is prolific and intuitive. She knew this music would resonate with people at this particular moment. She hadn't been relatable in a very long time, but her approach to this album struck at the heart of our human condition in 2020. She wrote in her foreword, "In isolation, my imagination has run wild, and this album is the result, a collection of songs and stories that flowed like a stream of consciousness. Picking up a pen was my way of escaping into fantasy, history, and memory. I've told these stories to the best of my abilities with all the love, wonder, and whimsy they deserve. Now, it's up to you to pass them down." The pandemic was kind of the best time ever to release an album, if you think about it. We were all at home searching for something to do. Of course, we'd already received Dua Lipa's Future Nostalgia, which provided us with some bangers to pretend that we still had the ability to dance and be free. We also had Charlie's Brooding How I'm Feeling Now, which in its own way captures how it feels to be in isolation when you are a specific kind of party person. But in my opinion, Taylor Swift's chronicling of the experience of lockdown and isolation was the most impactful because it was the most expansive subject-wise. The literal sound of it also matched the experiences that people were having with their real lives. How many former party girls did you see convening with nature on hours-long hikes posted on their Instagram stories? There's a naturalness to the production, the texture of the outdoors, a sense of escape and return. And of course, because Taylor Swift understands what people want from her better than anyone else, it struck all the right chords with literally everyone. The fans will eat anything up, but this reignited many people's love for Taylor Swift as a serious artist. It earned her back some credibility with the adult contemporary market after ceding ground to... Critics were similarly taken aback by this return to form. I'll get into why exactly it was a critical darling later on. Let's do some numbers though. In just its first week, the album sold over 2 million copies globally, and in the US, it debuted at number one on the Billboard 200 with 846,000 album equivalent units, including 615,000 in pure sales, despite being released with no prior promotion. It marked Taylor's seventh number one album in the US and secured the biggest debut week of 2020 at the time. On streaming platforms, Folklore broke records, accumulating over 500 million global audio and video streams in its first week. In the US alone, it earned approximately 289 million on-demand audio streams, making it the largest streaming week ever for a female artist. Critically, the album was met with near universal acclaim. It holds a Metacritic score of 88 out of 100, a career best for her. Most serious music publications praised it for its lyrical nuance and sonic restraint. But beyond the numbers and the reviews, Folklore shifted the public narrative around Taylor Swift, presenting her as not just a pop chameleon, but a serious literary songwriter. It won Album of the Year at the 2021 Grammy Awards, making her the first female artist in history to win that award three times alongside Fearless and 1989. In every metric, sales, streaming, critical reception, and cultural influence, Folklore completely reset Taylor's career, reestablishing her as a historic creative force, not a pop star past her sell-by date making songs to be played at Claire's. Let's dive into how she achieved this, shall we? I want to start with the songwriting because that is always paramount when it comes to Taylor Swift. As a longtime fan, I resonated so much with Folklore immediately because it sounded like she had reconnected with the younger version of herself to whom I was so deeply attached. The Taylor Swift of debut Fearless and Speak Now spoke of songwriting like it was her life source, a compulsion, an energy that flowed through her that could only be translated through song. She confirms this return to form in the Long Pond Studio Sessions interview.
This lockdown could have been a time where I absolutely lost my mind, and instead this album was like a real flotation device.
We can see this so beautifully depicted in her clinging to her piano as a literal life raft in a stormy sea in the Cardigan music video. What resonated with me emotionally about the bravery behind Folklore is how much letting go it took Taylor Swift to get there. She also said in the Long Pond Studio Sessions that
there's something about the complete and total uncertainty about life that causes endless anxiety, but there's another part that causes sort of a release of the pressures that you used to feel.
And she continued,
there have been times in my life where things have fallen apart so methodically and I couldn't control how things were going wrong and nothing I did stopped it.
And that's what she's freed from on this record. There was a sense of relief and unburdening communicated through all of Folklore. Even when these songs are about heavier topics, there is a lightness and a sense of whimsy, of ease, of imagination and fun all over it. An older model of Taylor Swift might have thought through all of the creative decisions made here with much more precision and perhaps with a more discerning eye. When we look at what transpired in the process of writing Red versus what it became with the Vault songs as our knowledge of what was left off, there was so much devastating material excised from the final product because it was too much. On Folklore, that too muchness is indulged and the artist is liberated. She writes about her inclination to perform and adjust and perfect on the most revealing autobiographical moment, Mirror Ball. I'm still on that tightrope. I'm still trying everything to get you laughing at me. I'm still a believer, but I don't know why. I've never been a natural. All I do is try, try, try. I'm still on that trapeze. I'm still trying everything just to keep you looking at me. Another standout moment from Folklore that I think is often overlooked, but is a perfect example of what the emotional shift in Taylor Swift's lyricism was from this period of time, is her recounting of childhood. It's actually very difficult to write from a child's perspective, I think. This specific wide-eyed, hopeful curiosity, the unburdened noticing of childhood, is beaten out of you as you become an adult. And most people don't really get to get in touch with that feeling again, especially with a hardened heart. Taylor manages to recapture this feeling on album highlight 7. This is a touching stream of consciousness. Taylor's perspective kind of shifts from looking back on her innocence and also living in the middle of it. Children are very perceptive, but not usually too articulate, and she captures that balance gorgeously here with the very careful language she chooses. As children, there's so much that you don't understand about the world around you, evils and upsets that hopefully don't register because you haven't met them yet. We see this in the climax of 7. I've been meaning to tell you, I think your house is haunted. Your dad is always mad, and that must be why. This is a really naive and childlike way of perceiving domestic discomfort. It must be magic or the afterlife causing this because I believe in the goodness of people, and I haven't been shown yet why I shouldn't. But perhaps the most liberating decision Taylor has ever made in her career was on Folklore, to widen her lens, to focus on narrating other people's stories, both real and invented characters, with, of course, a very Taylor Swift spin on her reportage. This served an important function for Taylor the artist and Taylor the public figure. First of all, it removed a self-imposed shackle, the need to write 100% autobiographically. And it also provided her with an excellent cover, should she accidentally veer towards the truth under the guise of fiction. I told you guys this was all made up, huh? It's Folklore. In fact, I want you to gossip about all of these stories and makeup theories and further abstract it from my real life. It lets me hide in plain sight, as she would later reveal to us on Dear Reader. Isn't it kind of ironic that fictionalizing her own story is what ended up bringing her real-life control of what is said about her to the absolute maximum? She's always loved to control the narrative, but with Folklore, she moved further towards, there will be no explanation. I will let the work stand for itself, and if I want to steer the conversation, I'll do it on my own, which she did expertly in the Long Pond studio sessions where she performed all of Folklore live for the first time, talked through it with her collaborators, and you know what? Sidebar, this is probably the smartest Grammy campaigning she has ever done. All of this to say, fiction freed her, as she said in the Long Pond studio sessions.
I think that's been my favorite thing about this album is that it's allowed to exist on its own merit without it just being, oh, people are listening to this because it tells them something that they could read in a tabloid.
And the truth that was on Folklore was so much juicier material than anything that could be written in a tabloid. You just had to know where to look. What makes Folklore and Evermore so unique is that she'll likely never really be able to hide in plain sight like this again. We are too attuned to mining for clues now, and the revelations made on Midnight's and Tortured Poets Department have revealed that Folklore was a lot more biographical than it purported itself to be. Even examining just the songs that were co-written with Joe Alwyn, oh girls, that breakup was not written in invisible ink. I won't get too much into that because I have like a million videos about obfuscation on Folklore and Evermore, but I do think that one of the most brilliant things about fictionalizing parts of this record was that it allowed her to keep doing what she's always done, processing her relationship in real time, writing about the good, the bad, and the ugly, while effectively throwing the media off the scent by just saying, it was all made up. Genius. Part of the reason why this record exists at all is because of Joe's insistence on privacy and his reluctance to participate in her public life. And so we say thank you, Heirloom Turkey, for doing that. And then we have an album highlight, My Tears Ricochet, a song that wears the veil of metaphor, but is, let's be honest, one of the most devastatingly confessional tracks she's ever written. She's not pretending here. She's just dressing the truth in mourning clothes. On the surface, it's a haunting funeral dirge, a ghost lingering at her own memorial while her greatest enemy shows up to grieve. But if you even halfway followed the Big Machine debacle, it's impossible not to hear this as a direct message to Scott Borchetta. This is Taylor confronting the man who discovered her, built her career, and then, in her eyes, betrayed her by selling her masters to a figure she despises. The lyric, I didn't have it in myself to go with grace, is not a fictional character's complaint. It's Taylor calling her own reaction exactly what it was. Messy and emotional and righteous. And when she sings, you wear the same jewels that I gave you as you bury me, she's referencing more than just symbolic betrayal. She's pointing to the grotesque irony of her former label continuing to profit off of the work she created, even after gutting her ability to control it. She described the song as being about the villain that used to be the best friend, which, hello, is almost too on the nose to not be about Scott Borchetta. But by delivering it through ghostly imagery and the language of the afterlife, she created enough distance to preserve the Folklore illusion. Oh, this is all just a story, fiction, nothing to see here. And yet, it bleeds with grief and rage and a betrayal so specific it could only come from a lived experience. My Tears Ricochet proves that even when she's hiding behind a narrative, Taylor Swift is still writing from the wound. Taylor is also, I think, too proud to admit defeat or hurt in an active conflict where she hasn't won yet, so I don't think she would have been able to write something this deeply sorrowful and not defensive or reactive about her master's situation if she didn't have the protection of the premise of Folklore. It's all made up. Folklore also wouldn't exist if Taylor Swift wasn't first and foremost a C-U-N-T-R-Y songwriter. Two of the best written moments on this record are directly inspired by the genre that seemed completely neglected and left behind in the pivots to 1989, Reputation and Lover. Let's start with a little song called The Last Great American Dynasty. It doesn't twang, but The Last Great American Dynasty is pure country at the core, just dressed up in folklore's muted grays. Strip away the indie veneer, and what you have is a classic country story song in the tradition of Dolly, Reba, and the Chicks. A small town scandal, a misunderstood woman, and a reputation so poisoned by gossip, it practically writes the verses itself. It's linear, it's plot-driven, and it's packed with concrete detail. Saltbox houses, green dogs that elevate the mundane into myth. The refrain shifts meaning with each chorus, eventually collapsing the distance between Taylor and Rebecca Harkness in a perfect country twist ending. It's gossip as heritage and judgment as muse, and it shows that even when she's pivoting towards fiction, Taylor can't escape the genre that taught her how to spin a life, hers or someone else's, into legend. And what makes The Last Great American Dynasty so sly and so Taylor is that while it does kind of purport to be a detached historical character study, it's actually one of the most autobiographical songs on folklore. The big twist, of course, is that the infamous saltbox house Rebecca Harkness once owned in Watch Hill, Rhode Island, Taylor owns it now. The woman the town gossiped about for throwing chaotic parties and refusing to be properly demure, Taylor literally stepped into her house, her narrative, and eventually her role. In the final verse, when she sings, "I had a marvelous time ruining everything," she's not speaking as Rebecca, she's speaking as herself, with the full knowledge that her neighbors have said the exact same things about her so many years later. This is where the fiction folds back into fact. Taylor becomes the new town pariah, the new misunderstood woman, too rich, too famous, too attention-grabbing for the comfort of coastal elite money. She's always been obsessed with how people talk about her, and in this song, she flips the script, aligning herself with another woman maligned for refusing to behave. The beauty of the song is that it pretends to be about someone else until it isn't. Now, moving on to Betty, which is arguably the most overtly country song on folklore, and not just because of the harmonica, Betty marks Taylor's full circle return to the storytelling roots of her debut, but with sharper craft, deeper emotional stakes, and a subtle wink to her past. Structurally, it's a classic country apology song written from the perspective of a boy, James, who screwed up and is trying to win back the girl, Betty, after a public fallout. You could easily imagine a male country artist cutting this track with the exact same lyrics and nobody blinking an eye. What makes it especially country is the directness of the narrative. It's conversational. It's full of specific teenage detail. You heard the rumors from Inez, I was walking home on broken cobblestones, and it builds towards a very plain-spoken emotional payoff. I showed up at your party. That's textbook country songwriting, confession wrapped in small town geography and adolescent shame. It is vulnerable, it is a little immature, and it is very earnest in a way that only country music can get away with. But Betty also operates on a meta level as part of the folklore teenage love triangle, a narrative thread woven across three songs, Betty, August, and Cardigan. Each song tells a different piece of the same story, from James the cheater, Betty, to the other woman, August, and to Betty herself in Cardigan. This kind of multi-perspective songwriting, playing with time, memory, and POV, is something that Taylor sharpened during her country years. And here she uses it to create a layered emotional portrait that's bigger than any one song. Betty may be on Taylor's indie record that's much cooler than her pop records, but it's pure country. Let's talk about how this album sounds, the production, because that's a huge part of why folklore was able to cross party lines and unite Taylor agnostics with fans and haters. She reeled in a lot of people and gained back a lot of the listeners that she lost along the way in her pivot to pop. Taylor's collaborations with Jack Antonoff by 2020 were notorious. She had worked with him on three records, and his production style was quite polarizing. He definitely has a Bleachers footprint that he leaves on Taylor's work, particularly in a song like Getaway Car. People tend to really like or really dislike Jack Antonoff's thing. Is his work with Taylor respected by the real critics in the music industry? Depends on who it's coming from. If it's coming from Lana Del Rey, then yes, they can do the same thing over and over to critical acclaim. But with Taylor, they were calling it stale before it had even really gotten started. But with all that aside, Taylor clearly trusted Jack deeply and would obviously turn to him to create her top secret pandemic surprise album. However, she had a dream. A dream that had been percolating for years. She had always loved The National and Aaron Dessner's songwriting and production specifically. They had been circling each other for a few years before Taylor put herself out there randomly and asked if he would be interested in collaborating with her in the early days of the pandemic. It's really interesting to hear both of their different perspectives on how this meeting of minds happened. Aaron's perspective is kind of like, why the hell does the world's biggest pop star want to work with me? What can I offer her? Whereas Taylor was coming from quite an intense place of insecurity. She wasn't sure that she was good enough anymore to interest him as a serious songwriter. The National has a lot of indie credibility. They are some of the best to ever do it, and the right people in the industry, aka the Pitchfork crowd, the pretentious music reviewers, deeply respect his work and his taste. Collaborating with him was a big surprise to pretty much everyone, a plot twist that no one expected, especially after the colorful campiness of Lover. And it afforded Taylor Swift something she sorely needed in this rebrand, credibility. Aaron's attachment to the project ensured that it would be received a certain way by the industry. And if we're being honest, it set her up for success in a way that another collaboration with Joel Little or Max Martin certainly wouldn't have. What's interesting about Aaron is that he has a relatively light touch when it comes to the actual production work itself. Nothing on Folklore sonically, except for a few key moments that I'll talk about, are truly new to Taylor Swift's music. I think he's actually been most effective and impactful with Taylor as a co-writer by encouraging her to stay open while she writes and leading her away from the hooky pop formulas that she had been honing for years, sacrificing detail for. She became more adventurous structurally with the work that she was creating here. She worked almost entirely over email and voice notes with Aaron Dessner. It was a pandemic, obviously they couldn't meet in person or record together. He sent instrumentals, and Taylor would often return complete songs just hours later. She's credited him with radically reshaping her creative process, ushering her into a world where she could let go of overthinking, loosen her grip on autobiographical writing, and explore character-driven fictional storytelling. She's spoken often about his generous spirit, his humility, and his instinctive artistry, and she has described their work together as liberating and intuitive. You can hear that spirit of experimentation most clearly on Epiphany. Bet you thought you weren't going to hear me say that name in this video. Not one of my favorite songs, but it is one of the most unusual tracks in Taylor's entire discography. It's slow, it's spacious, almost sacred in its pacing. The production resists resolution. There's no beat drop, no bridge chorus arc, just a glacial ambient wash of strings and piano. It doesn't beg for attention, which makes it kind of more haunting. Lyrically, it's also a departure. Epiphany is written in the third person, and it moves between two very different vantage points, the battlefield and the hospital. It draws a quiet line between her grandfather's trauma as a soldier and the modern day sacrifices of healthcare workers during COVID. The effect is almost cinematic, like watching two lives play out on a split screen, unified by an unspoken suffering. This is not the kind of song that Taylor would have written or would have had the space to release on Reputation or Lover. With Aaron's help, she stepped outside of the need to explain or confess and instead created something atmospheric, impressionistic, and solemn. It's less about catharsis and more about bearing witness. Returning to a thought that I shared earlier, that none of the production on Folklore is truly new, there is, however, a sense of novelty created in the atmosphere that Aaron designed. Aaron Dessner's production on Exile is a perfect showcase of the atmosphere he brought to Folklore. It's not flashy, it's textural, almost cinematic in its restraint. In the opening verse, you can hear the faint hum of the wind, the distant chirp of cicadas, subtle piano chords that echo like footsteps in an empty hallway. It creates this eerie, quiet tension that perfectly matches the emotional stalemate the song is capturing. It's a breakup song, but it's less about drama and it's more about that cold, hollow feeling of being chronically misunderstood, of speaking two different emotional languages with the person you care most about. Bon Iver's presence here as a duet partner immediately signaled to the indie crowd that this was a different kind of Taylor Swift song. It's no surprise to me that Exile was one of the songs on the album that was pushed to the public. His gravelly baritone grounds the track and contrasts very well with Taylor's smoother vocal. Their voices don't just sound good together, though. They act. It's a duet in the true sense. These two characters are circling each other in a fog of miscommunication. What's also fascinating is the writing credit on this. Exile marks one of the first times that Taylor allowed a man, not a collaborator, a boyfriend, to co-write lyrics with her, and it just so happens that man was William Bowery, Joe Alwyn's secret pseudonym. For what reason we did that, I don't know. In hindsight, the whole Bowery thing is kind of hilarious. He contributed to most of her Crisis songs, the ones loaded with heartbreak and tension, Exile, Betty, Champagne Problems later on, as if he was unintentionally foreshadowing his own arc in her discography. He even got a production credit on Exile, and Taylor didn't, which is deranged when you consider how meticulous and controlling she is usually about authorship, but it all speaks to the experimental spirit of Folklore. She was letting go of old rules and letting new voices in. And the thing is, it's not just fans who bought into Folklore's hype. Critics who have historically treated Taylor with a kind of polite skepticism suddenly sounded like they were reviewing a Joni Mitchell record. The album landed in 88, as I mentioned, on Metacritic, the highest score of her career, signaling universal acclaim, a rarity for any mainstream pop act, let alone one who just 3 years prior had been memed into oblivion with the words, "The old Taylor can't come to the phone right now." The Guardian gave it a perfect 5 out of 5, declaring that Taylor's imagistic and emotionally rich lyricism had reached new heights, and that Folklore quietly recenters her as a visionary artist instead of just a celebrity. Pitchfork, yes, Pitchfork, who famously dragged many of her pop efforts, gave it an 8 and said it felt like she had finally found a space in indie folk that was organic and deeply personal. Even The Independent called it a career best and praised its astonishing maturity and restraint, both sonically and lyrically. And NME dubbed it her most convincing reinvention yet, applauding its fantastically vivid vignettes, while Variety described it as the work of a gifted writer at the height of her powers, comfortable enough to shed persona and lay bare her obsessions, be they romantic, literary, or mythic. And then came the Grammys. Folklore won Album of the Year in 2021, not as a pop behemoth, but as an introspective, genre-blurring piece of work that Taylor made quietly in the woods with her indie friends. In her speech, she credits Aaron and Jack for unlocking a kind of creative freedom she'd never allowed herself to fully explore before. The Telegraph called this win a rare feat, noting that by stripping back the gloss and letting her storytelling take center stage, Taylor Swift had won over even the most ardent skeptics. The New York Times said it best. This was a victory not just for Taylor, but for intimate, literary, emotionally resonant folk music, the kind that rarely gets recognized on pop's biggest stage. That critical embrace and the Grammy win that followed didn't just validate the risk that she took with Folklore, it affirmed something much deeper, that when she stopped trying to prove herself, the work finally did it for her. 5 years on, folklore doesn't just hold up, it looms larger than ever. It opened a portal not only for Taylor, but for the entire pop industry. Suddenly, intimacy is back in style. Artists like Lorde with Solar Power, Kacey Musgraves with Starcrossed, Olivia Rodrigo with Certain Moments on Sour and Guts, and Gracie Abrams' Entire Thing, all found commercial and creative lane in restraint. The cottagecore boom, that was folklore's footprint, and Taylor made softness scalable and minimalism marketable. More than that, though, folklore permanently shifted how we talk about Taylor Swift. Critics who once rolled their eyes at her pop maximalism began engaging with her work like it was literature. She wasn't just writing hits anymore, she was writing art. That repositioning bought her an enormous amount of critical goodwill and unlocked the creative freedom that she used to capitalize with the Torture Poets Department. Folklore was less a rebrand and more of a reframing. She stopped begging to be liked, and that's when she was really understood. And then, of course, there's the Eras Tour, which doesn't exist, at least not in the same way, without folklore. This album cracked open her mythology, giving her the sonic and narrative range to frame her discography as chapters in a larger story. Without folklore, the tour would have been a greatest hits parade. With it, folklore was actually, if you really think about it, the theatrical epic of the Eras Tour. It was so clearly her favorite part of the show, and as she keeps telling us, the album that she's most proud of. It was the kind of artistic pivot that creates before and after lines in a career. There is a before folklore time and an after folklore time for Taylor Swift. So will it be the album that she's most remembered for? Maybe not on a numbers level, like 1989, Midnight's Lover, those will always maybe reign supreme. But in terms of artistic weight, emotional resonance, and cultural half-life, this feels like the one that will echo the longest. It's her record that will be studied, referenced, and quietly worshipped. Folklore proved that she doesn't need to be allowed to be legendary. And what made it so resonant, so quietly explosive, wasn't just the sonic pivot or the surprise release. It was the fact that for the first time in years, Taylor let the work speak for itself. She stopped trying to win the argument. She stopped defending her choices. Instead, she disappeared into the woods, into metaphor, into other people's lives. And in doing so, she gave herself something she'd been craving for years without knowing how to ask for. Privacy. Ironically, that privacy made the work feel more intimate than anything she'd released since Red. The layer of fiction gave her just enough distance to say what she really meant. Songs like Mirrorball and My Tears Ricochet are still deeply personal, but they're veiled, dreamlike, and unguarded in a way that her pop eras never allowed. The confessions on folklore don't plead to be understood, they just are. They float. And maybe that's why this record landed like it did. It wasn't designed to dominate charts or culture, it simply arrived in a moment when everyone was feeling still, cracked open, and quietly desperate to feel seen. The pandemic forced reflection, stillness, and sincerity, and the world had stopped turning. Reality felt surreal, and folklore mirrored that. It didn't shout, it whispered. It felt like a secret. It was a rare moment when the artist, the audience, and the culture were all on the same page. Folklore captured not just a sound, but a state of mind, and in doing so, Taylor Swift reminded everyone, herself included, that her greatest superpower isn't her ability to dominate the news cycle or engineer a viral moment. It's her ability to sit with a feeling, crack it open, and hand you the pieces like a memory you forgot was yours. 5 years later, to me, it is still her bravest album, because for all the myths, masks, and mirrors she's built her career on, folklore is where she finally stepped behind the curtain and somehow showed us her truest self.